Hey, it's Brad Milkey, host of ABC's daily news podcast, Start Here. And I'm honored to say Start Here, along with several ABC audio projects, are up for Webby Awards. Voting is open to the public, and we're all really excited about these awards, but this vote closes on Thursday. So please don't wait. You can go to abcaudio.com/webbies. That's abcaudio.com/webbies, W-E-B-B-Y-S, to cast your vote for Start Here, along with other ABC news shows. Really appreciate it.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the U.S. moves away from herd immunity and raises its target for vaccinations.
I don't know if we're going to hit herd immunity or not, and I don't mean to be flippant, but I don't know if I care. What I care about is let's get the virus under control, let's get our lives back, and I'm pretty confident we can do that.
How Chinatown is working together to revitalize its businesses.
Being in lockdown for the first month, of course, there's a lot of anxiety, but I think that's when ideas started bubbling within the community. How are we going to help the businesses that aren't surviving?
And buying a home, it's become nearly impossible for a lot of people across the country.
So you're willing to give up your 49ers season ticket for a home offer?
With a heavy heart.
All ahead on Perspective. The Biden administration set a new benchmark for vaccines this week, getting nearly three-quarters of Americans the shot by Independence Day. The CDC is now predicting a sharp decline in overall COVID cases by July because so many people have gotten vaccinated so far and because people are still social distancing and keeping on the masks, at least for now. We've got that story coming up, but we're going to begin with a reunion of family members separated at the southern border 4 years ago. Brian was just 15 years old when he was separated from his mother, Sandra Ortiz, under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. Now, they've been reunited. This sound from Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. The reunion came at the same point of entry, San Ysidro, where Sandra was separated from her son and deported in 2017. Later that night, Mabel, a mother from Honduras, surprised her two sons at a family gathering in Philadelphia and locked them in for a tearful group hug for the first time in over 3 years. This sound also from Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. Families are among the first to be reunited by organizations working with the Biden administration's Family Reunification Task Force. This comes as many of the unaccompanied minors who cross the southern border are moved from overcrowded Border Patrol facilities to Health and Human Services shelters. But there is still an increase of children coming to the U.S. ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Cecilia Vega has covered the border crisis for years. She's got more on the family reunifications from this week.
Advocates have spent years trying to find parents in Mexico and Central America. The Biden administration says the Trump White House left them with little to no information about many of the families. There are still more than 400 children whose parents have yet to be located. Sandra Ortiz, among four families this week reunited under the Biden administration. She hugged her son Brian for the first time in more than 3 years. Deported to Mexico without him, Brian stayed with older siblings in California, learning English, graduating high school a year early.
It feels like a dream.
The administration says more families will be reunited soon, but for now, these are tears of joy. This mother saying, "I love you, my beautiful son."
All of these families are going to receive temporary protected status for humanitarian reasons. They can stay in the country legally temporary. Advocates are calling for permanent legal protection given all the trauma these families have endured. This is hardly the end of the story for these families.
ABC Cecilia Vega, our Chief White House correspondent, joining us now. Cecilia, tell us more about that reunion that took place in Philadelphia. What's the story with that family? The mom reunited with her sons after nearly 4 years.
This is one of the 1,000-plus families that was separated under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy at the border. They were forcibly separating parents from kids when they had come forward to claim asylum in the hopes that that would deter other migrants from coming forward. The ramifications of that left thousands of families separated, thousands and thousands, to be honest. There are still more than 1,000 families that remain separated. And this family that we saw reunited, they're among four that are being reunited under the Biden administration this week. This is a mother. She's from Honduras. She was separated from her two sons at the border back in 2017. She was deported back to Honduras after spending nearly 2 years in an ICE detention center, and she has been essentially trying to get back to her children. But because of, you know, the policies under the last administration and the crackdown at the border, she wasn't allowed to come back through any legal channels through an asylum claim. And the Biden administration has created this task force to reunite these families, and she and their family were part of this reunification process. And she walked in on her sons in a family gathering in Philadelphia. They were actually taping a video to send to her because they missed her so much. And she, boy, just get your tissues out when you see this. She walked in on them, and to say the emotional reaction was really something. They hadn't seen each other in more than 3 years.
This story of what's been going on at the border with immigrants, tell us what it means to you to cover stories like this and to tell these kinds of stories.
Well, I think this story in particular should mean a lot to every American who lives in this country because it is an American story. We are a nation of immigrants. And what happened at that border under the Trump administration with this policy was unlike anything we'd ever seen before. And we didn't know it was happening at the time. We didn't know until a year in. And the administration, to this day, the Trump administration still faces a lot of questions about why they felt the need to do this and whether this was a humane way of treating people who were coming to our country to claim asylum. And what we see with these videos right now is the real human toll of a government policy to separate people at the border. We're seeing gut-wrenching reunions, families who haven't seen each other in years. We're talking about people who are trying to use the legal asylum process because they're fleeing some of the most dangerous, violent, impoverished countries in the entire world. And they came here, and not only was the door closed on them, they were separated from their family in some pretty horrible situations.
How has it been covering the immigration story now as compared to covering the immigration story during the Trump administration?
Well, the Biden administration has a lot of questions they have to answer about how they are handling the immigration policy and what has been described by many as a crisis at the southern border. We saw record numbers of people attempting to cross in the month of March alone, particularly unaccompanied minors. I was down there and met 6 and 7 and 9 year old boys who traveled across the border themselves.
He's going to show me a phone number. This is his grandfather's phone number.
We're talking about really dangerous situations for children and families. And a lot of critics of the Biden administration say they were ill-prepared for the onslaught of people who tried to cross the border after the president took office and so quickly overturned so many of Donald Trump's former policies. And so I think the administration has a lot of questions about whether they were ready, whether they were fully prepared for some of the actions that they took early on.
Cecilia Vega, our chief White House correspondent here at ABC News, thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Biden now says he wants 70% of American adults vaccinated by the 4th of July. The president acknowledging this week what scientists have been saying for months, eradicating the coronavirus might not be possible, but if enough Americans get some protection, it'll become manageable. So what happened to that whole herd immunity thing we heard so much about? It's probably not happening. Dr. John Brownstein is a Harvard professor and an epidemiologist at Boston Children's Hospital. He's also an ABC News medical contributor, and he talked about the dimming prospect of herd immunity in the U.S. with ABC's Devin Dwyer on the Daily Podcast Start Here.
John, you're part of this growing consensus of public health experts who say herd immunity is a bit of a mirage, but maximizing shots in arms still needs to be the goal.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think it was a good sort of stretch goal to think how much can we get the population immunized in a way that really protects the vast majority of us. Problem is, it's going to be unlikely to get to a point where we can bring cases down to zero, and then you're going to have underlying transmission. There are places that are hesitant and or rural communities that are limited in access. You're just going to have pockets where you might have underlying transmission. So it's likely that COVID will be part of this winter mix of respiratory viruses that we deal with every year. Now, not as severe because it doesn't have the same impact with the vaccine, but it could still be with us for a while. I think regardless, you know, of herd immunity or not, it makes absolute sense to get as many people immunized right now.
All right, so maybe there's no magic number, but the Biden administration is setting a new goal. They want 70% vaccination rate by July 4th. Why that target? What would that mean?
You know, there isn't any magic number, but getting to 70% of the U.S. population to have one vaccine and essentially 160 million U.S. adults being fully vaccinated gets us really far. We've seen in other countries like Israel where you cross like a threshold of 50% being vaccinated and you really start to see a major decline. Now, here we have unevenness across the country in terms of vaccine rollout and also some natural immunity to the virus. So that combination, I think 70% means that we could really have a normal July 4th and essentially a normal summer.
But we know we're going to get to a place where the doubters exist or the people who just are, I don't want to say lazy, just not sure how to get to where they want to go. It's going to be hard. So we're going to keep at it.
Now, at the current pace, it's doable. But as we see these declines in vaccines, you know, there's going to be some work that needs to be done to make up some ground.
Quarter of the population is under the age of 21. And so we're really actually starting to hear for the first time now the administration and public health officials talk about moving into that demographic more aggressively. How significant is that piece of this pie?
First of all, kids are an important element. You know, they represent 20% of the population. And if we're going to get to numbers and high percentage of immunity, they're key to that. So getting this approval is key, but also, you know, there's going to be an important conversation between family doctors and parents and kids about the vaccine and why it's important. But all signs point to this being an incredibly safe vaccine, totally fine in pediatric populations.
Dr. John Brownstein, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And since the pandemic began in the U.S., the nation has seen a significant uptick in violence against Asian American communities. But here in New York City, a new generation is mobilizing to protect the elderly and family-run businesses. ABC's Eva Pilgrim has more on how Chinatown has transformed amid COVID-19 and the rise in racist attacks.
Here in the heart of New York City's Chinatown, there are signs that life is slowly getting back to normal. The global pandemic wreaked havoc on this close-knit community, both financially and emotionally. Once thriving businesses, now permanently closed, and residents concerned and in some cases fearful for their safety.
Asian lives matter!
As racist attacks continue to plague the Asian American community here and across the country.
Grand opening!
Pearl River Mart owner Joanne Kwong rallying to take care of her neighbors, especially the elderly.
We've done a couple of different initiatives that we're super proud of. One is called Light Up Chinatown, and we ended up having people adopt a lantern, and you can go visit your lantern in Chinatown. It basically brightens up the street for our elders, you know, walking the streets at night so that they feel a little bit safer.
Established in 1971, Pearl River Mart became the first Chinese department store in the U.S. Today, a new location and a new chapter in a long history.
It's about bringing people together, providing a space. And for 50 years, because this is our 50th anniversary, Pearl River has been that community space for Chinatown and for the Chinatown community. But we feel very proud to be Asian here, and we want to share kind of culture and space.
And here, Doyer Street, home to Wilson Tang's Nam Wah Tea Parlor, which just last year celebrated their 100-year anniversary.
One of the major challenges during the pandemic was just keeping our staff safe.
Wilson is heartened and inspired by his community's actions.
I am really proud of today's young adults who are mobilizing to help the elderly in need, help sign up for vaccines or to help them with personal safety devices, because we're not here without them.
Being in lockdown for the first month, of course, there's a lot of anxiety, but I think that's when ideas started bubbling within the community. How are we going to help the businesses that aren't surviving?
Like Wilson, Corey Ng, too, was born and raised here, opening up Milk and Cream Cereal Bar 4 years ago. The shop then partnered with other businesses in the area.
When Chinatown really needed the help, when the elderly needed meals, when businesses needed fundraising, everyone came together. It's a lot of little micro organizations doing their individual parts with all the same mission.
The new generation embodying the same resilience and fortitude exemplified by their ancestors who first came to the U.S. and called these streets home.
And ABC's Eva Pilgrim is here now to talk more about it. What are we looking at when Chinatown, you're talking about coming back from where it was? How did it fare during the pandemic?
Chinatown's one of those unique places. And what makes it special is that it's all these small family-owned businesses. So before we even started to see the shutdowns, I've heard from business owners in Chinatown that they saw a lack of people wanting to come to that area starting about January when we started to hear about the coronavirus. Then we had the major shutdown here in New York in March. A lot of them had to pivot to figure out, okay, how do we maintain some sort of income? How do we make this business functioning when we can't depend on people coming by? Several of them just suffered, like so many businesses all across the country. But that coupling of the anti-Asian sentiment with the struggle and hardship that was just this pandemic, that has created this environment in that area where all of these small family-owned businesses, a lot of them now being run by second, third generation, fourth generation family members, started to treat each other like family. Making sure that all of those businesses survived is a huge part of what that community is. And they've really like leaned and depended on each other. There were a large number of shops and restaurants that closed in Chinatown, but that sort of leaning on each other, helping each other, I think is really unique to that community.
You talk a lot about younger people helping older people. Was it always that way in Chinatown? In Chinatowns, I should say, because there are many of them all across the country.
I would say you have to think about how these businesses are run, right? So these kids grow up in these shops with their parents, with their grandparents, running the counters. So, you know, a lot of these families have gotten to know each other over the time. And I would say the younger generation is much more vocal, much more, we're going to do something, than their grandparents or even their parents. And so this idea that we're going to take care of our own, we're not going to let our grandmother and our grandfathers be attacked on the street. I mean, elderly in Chinese culture, the elderly are kind of revered. A lot of them started to band together and come up with these safety groups, walking people to subways, to grocery stores, making sure people were getting places safely, doing community watch, like try to like stem off any problems before they happened. They were doing that in all of these communities that have strong Asian presences. It's really interesting to me. The vaccine uptake in the Asian American community in New York is actually really high. It's the number one group of people who have been vaccinated. And a lot of that is because of these community groups that specifically take care of their elderly. They're helping them find vaccine appointments, making sure they're able to get to a vaccine appointment so that they can get the vaccine and have some feeling of safety and security through that.
Do you see a tie between the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes and the way that the pandemic and the way that COVID were, you know, characterized from the very beginning?
I mean, I think it's hard to ignore the link that exists there, right? Asian American hate crimes existed pre-COVID. Let's be real about that. But the numbers that we saw as COVID came and the language that was used around the coronavirus, the hate crimes in New York City that were reported went up more than 800%. And those are the ones that NYPD has reported. It was so bad that NYPD launched an entire task force specifically to deal with this issue. These were crimes that were happening in the middle of the day, oftentimes in crowded areas, and they're targeting older people, you know, the most vulnerable people in our community, oftentimes just out running their normal daily errands, going to the grocery store or stopping by a bakery or on their way to church, those kinds of things. The need to do something about it in those communities, there was no question that the numbers reflect there is a dramatic increase in hate crimes that have happened over the last year.
That was ABC's Eva Pilgrim. Coming up, buying a home? Good luck. Why so many Americans are getting priced out of once affordable homes. on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, when it comes to the race to get people into space, why one company is lagging behind. But first, a house across the street from me in the suburbs of New Jersey went on sale this week. The first day it was on the market, there must have been 30 cars out front, all belonging to people hoping to buy a home in the craziest housing market since the bubble burst back during the recession. With so many people ditching cities for more green space amid the pandemic, the race to put in offers has been called the Wild West. Americans, even those who are well off, are simply being priced out of the housing market. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze has more on families who are trying to buy but are ending up frazzled and frustrated.
When they started house hunting in the Bay Area last fall, Mashika and Abhinav Guha soon realized just how hot the market had become.
In November, we had a budget in our mind, and this would be the max we would go to. We have certainly blown out that number.
An engineering project manager and atmospheric scientist with a 16-month-old baby, they needed more space when the pandemic hit.
It's like we have three jobs. We have our full-time job, we have to take care of a baby, that's our job, and then there's a third job where we're house searching.
Nearly 100 home visits and 9 failed offers later, they're starting to get creative.
We've talked about maybe, including the season tickets.
So you're willing to give up your 49ers season tickets for a home offer?
With a heavy heart.
Their desperation resonating with families from coast to coast.
We've put in 8 bids so far in a month and a half.
We placed offers on 5 different homes.
We were outbid.
Real estate brokerage Redfin calls March the hottest month in housing history, with a record 43% of homes selling for more than their listing price. And nearly half of homes that went under contract had an accepted offer within 1 week of hitting the market. Realtors and economists say heated competition in the housing market comes down to basic economics. A lot of demand and not enough supply. Record low interest rates and remote working convinced many renters over the past year to try to buy a home. The problem? Existing homeowners aren't leaving their houses during the pandemic. And the cost of building new homes is surging thanks to backlogs in the supply chain of materials. To make up for the current shortage, federal mortgage lender Freddie Mac estimates the market needs 3.8 million more homes. This lack of new homes, combined with the surplus of potential buyers, is contributing to the biggest yearly increase in housing prices in 15 years.
It's really disheartening.
28-year-old Chanel Bell and her husband have been saving to buy their first home in their Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago.
But I'm outpriced. I was told, you do these things right, you will be able to attain the American dream. And I just am realizing I don't think that is a real thing.
Aspiring first-time buyers like Bell say they simply can't compete with offers putting forward all cash or waiving contingencies like inspections. And many buyers are being forced to make whirlwind decisions. The result, buyers across the country are getting pushed out.
And ABC's Elizabeth Schulze joins us now to talk about what's going on in this crazy housing market. How does this differ from what happened in the housing market in 2005-06 when there was the bubble? Because it was the same kind of situation. You had people making multiple offers. Somebody else is going to throw in, you know, their firstborn child to get this house. Is it the same kind of thing? But do the market conditions differ from then and now?
that mania definitely resonates with people who were trying to buy a home 15 years ago before the housing bubble burst. But realtors I've been speaking with say that there are a couple of big differences this time around.
As a buyer's agent, I'm having to give bad news to people more often than not. And as a listing agent, you know, I'm listing a house and I'll have 12 to 15, 20 offers on it. So while I have one person that I can call and give great news, I've got 19 others that I have to be the grim reaper.
A lot of these buyers are first-time buyers. So it's not people buying their second or third homes and that mania that we kind of saw. These are first-time buyers, a lot of them millennials who've been renting for many years, qualified buyers, they just can't find the homes. And that's very different than what we saw in the housing bust 15 years ago.
What does it do to cities where people have normally rented in the past? Are they seeing that as sort of like a real shift in dynamics when it comes to renters and what happens in big cities?
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many vacancies in big cities from the renting perspective. But one thing that's really notable is that home prices in cities are also higher. A lot of renters actually just decided to buy homes in the city if they could afford to make that down payment, which it is a really, really high threshold, I will say. But people are generally still buying in cities. So it doesn't look like there's just going to be this total vacancy altogether. We did speak with a lot of people who were looking to buy who were just totally priced out. The down payment had surged so much, or they couldn't compete in time. You know, some of these decisions had to be made within hours of going to look at the house. And it's hard to see people feeling like they can't have that home ownership dream that they had thought they might be able to have.
Well, Elizabeth Schulze, thanks so much. It's a great piece and a really interesting look at what's going on, not just, you know, in the Northeast, but all over the country right now. The housing market is insane. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
As Americans go to extremes to buy a home in the U.S. these days, tens of thousands of refugees are simply looking for a place to sleep. It's something that has been spiraling out of control in recent years, with a number of refugees continuing to climb. ABC News foreign correspondent James Longman recently traveled to Syria to report on the impact of the civil war. He gives us an inside look into how difficult life can be inside refugee camps, especially for children.
The Al-Hol refugee camp in the northeast of the country. It was set up for the families of ISIS members as their so-called caliphate fell. But with international attention elsewhere, it's now become an almost lawless, festering wound on the landscape. As extremism poisons the air, the innocents suffocate. And the cost is mounting. More than 22,000 children of at least 60 nationalities are still languishing here and at other camps and detention centres. UNICEF is among the charities working hard to find a future for them. Last year at their orphanage, we met 13-year-old Zakaria. He'd lost both legs in an explosion. For 2 years, he was stuck at Hull, paying for the crimes of others. But 1 year on, we got news that Zakaria had been given new legs and had left Al-Hol camp. Some hope at last. We sent our producer to find him. We found him, but the discovery was devastating.
Assalamu alaikum.
An uncle had claimed Zakaria, and so he'd been reunited with family. But he sits alone most of the day in a room he shares with seven other people. And the legs, they don't work.
I can't use them because the ground here is not flat, and the knees do not twist. So these prosthetics do not help me to walk. I don't know what to do, and we don't have the money to buy better ones.
Other families here have also left Hull camp and they're scraping an existence. UNICEF says the cost of the average food basket has gone up 230% in the last year. Water and bread is almost beyond their means. Zakaria and thousands like him need all the help they can get if they're going to stand any chance at all.
The United States has long been a leader in resettling refugees like Zakaria and his family, but in recent years, the number of displaced persons being allowed into the U.S. has dropped significantly. President Biden did announce just this week that his administration will now let in 62,500 refugees in the U.S., but as ABC News producer Jonah Haskell reports, many feel it's an optimistic goal, but still not enough.
It is one of the worst times for refugees, and not only refugees, but internally displaced persons.
Jennifer Syme is the Senior Vice President of Resettlement, Asylum, and Integration at the International Rescue Committee. She says there are currently more refugees and internally displaced people around the world than at any time since the end of the Second World War.
Right now, there's about 80 million people who are either refugees or internally displaced people.
The majority of immigrants around the world travel to other countries voluntarily. Refugees are people who have been forced to leave their country against their will because of violence, persecution, or natural disasters. Similar to refugees, internally displaced people have been able to remain in their countries of origin, but have still been forced to flee their homes. President Biden pledged to make the U.S. a leader in tackling the crisis, promising to raise the annual cap on refugee admissions to its highest point since the 1990s.
This executive order will position us to be able to raise the refugee admissions back up to 125,000 persons.
The president appeared to waver on that commitment somewhat in April, when a White House memo said that the Trump-era cap of just 15,000 would remain in place for the time being. But Biden announced on Monday that he is raising the cap on the number of refugees that will be allowed into the United States this fiscal year by more than four times. The administration does not expect to hit that new limit of 62,500 in the short time before the end of the fiscal year.
Right now it's in May, so we have about 4.5 months to process, as many people as we could.
Eskinder Nagash is president and CEO of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. He says hitting the cap this year is unlikely.
I don't believe that we'll be resettling 62,000.
Besides the time crunch, Nagash says the infrastructure that would be needed to resettle that many people just doesn't exist anymore.
The previous administration, the overseas processing infrastructure has been very much dismantled.
That infrastructure only gets funded if it is involved in actively resettling refugees. Refugee admissions plunged during the last 4 years. This had a devastating effect on the agency's ability to do their jobs going forward. It remains to be seen how many refugees will be able to come to the United States this year. The number to date is just over 2,000, but SIME from the International Rescue Committee expects it to climb well above the old cap.
We certainly have the capacity to go much higher than 15,000 without having a lot more money appropriated.
Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says raising the cap this year positions the program to meet next year's ambitious goal of 125,000.
It helps get the muscles working that have atrophied over the last several years.
Nagash from the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants has a similar mindset.
This is really good news for people who have been waiting in refugee camps and in urban slums.
SIME says doing anything less would be an abdication of U.S. leadership as the global refugee crisis worsens every day.
Refugees really do enrich this country and our society, and they have a lot to contribute.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Jonah Haskell, ABC News.
Finally this week, it seems to us here at Perspective there are two types of people in this world. Those who look to space and say, what's out there? I need to see it, to experience it, at whatever cost. And those who don't. Space tourism took a big leap forward this week thanks to the guy who founded Amazon, who is one of those fascinated with space. Here's ABC's Ken Moten.
The race to send tourists into space is taking off as Jeff Bezos' company Blue Origin announces it will launch its first sightseeing flight this summer. The first seat on the rocket will be auctioned off to the highest bidder. The winner will become the first private citizen to launch into space from U.S. soil.
Also this week, another space enthusiast, Elon Musk. His company took SpaceX to a new level as it landed its Starship rocket prototype without incident.
Starship 15 is airborne as we get a view of the three Raptor engines as we're powering our way.
They hope that craft to take astronauts to the moon and even Mars one day. But once upon a time, about 15 years ago, when people first began contemplating taking regular folks with a lot of money into space, there was a third company trying to do it, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. Back in 2018, ABC's Alex Stone watched as that company launched its rocket in a very different way.
Rolling down the California desert runway, Virgin Galactic's Unity space plane was about to make history. Unity was released from the belly of a larger plane and then using its rocket motor, it jetted to 51 miles above Earth, which is suborbital space. By definition, it makes the two pilots on board astronauts. Unity did a slow backflip and then glided back to the Mojave Desert.
Nicholas Schmidl, who writes for The New Yorker, describes it this way.
They are flying a winged spaceship. I mean, it looks like an airplane with a mothership towed up to altitude at about 45,000 feet, at which point the mothership drops the spaceship. The test pilots light the rocket, ignite the rocket. They fly vertically for about 3 or 4 seconds and then enter this very steep near vertical ascent. Suddenly, in the, like, I don't know, 45 degrees kind of from where you're sitting there on the runway, suddenly there's this, you know, it's a controlled explosion in the middle of the sky as the rocket lights. And then it traces this near kind of steep vertical arc into the heavens.
From the beginning, Schmidl was fascinated with the way Virgin was doing things. So he convinced his bosses to let him embed with a company in the Mojave Desert for 4 years. Now he's written a book about it, and the test pilot who helped create Virgin Galactic's space plan. It's called Test Gods.
For me, space was in some ways always a metaphor of what was beyond our reach in some ways.
Richard Branson saw space travel kind of the same way. Unlike Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, his vision was more of a human adventure than a highly precise numbers-based undertaking, even after a deadly crash at his company in 2014.
That accident was caused when a test pilot effectively lifted the emergency brake as the spaceship was almost going Mach 1. I mean, imagine lifting the emergency brake on the highway going 100 miles an hour. That's the kind of that was the sort of mistake. It was an unthinkable mistake. So the human element, yes, it is their foil in some ways, but it's also what makes them unique.
Okay, so we are doing this interview on the same day that Blue Origin is going to announce how much tickets will be aboard its 6-seat capsule that is coming up. We've seen SpaceX take astronauts actually to the International Space Station. Where is Virgin Galactic in all of this?
So they kind of started this space race with a pretty formidable and sizable lead. They have, however, discovered that building a commercially viable spaceship is much more difficult than developing and building a prototype. As they've been working through all of these problems and all of these various setbacks, and there's been tragedies in the desert. There was an accident in 2007 that killed 3 engineers. There was the crash in 2014 that killed the test pilot. And in the meantime, Blue Origin and SpaceX have, particularly SpaceX, has just surged ahead. I mean, if you would have asked anyone 15 years ago whether SpaceX would be flying NASA astronauts to the International Space Station, I think someone would think you're crazy. And at this point, if you were to tell me that Elon Musk was going to start flying NASA astronauts to Mars in 10 years, I don't know how you bet against that.
And so as one company looks to the heavens with longing, still committed to getting people up there, possibly next year, two other companies who set out with the same mission have lifted off and are doing it already. Nicholas Schmidl's book, Test Gods, Virgin Galactic and the Making of a Modern Astronaut, is published by Holt. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.